Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. It's our first annual What the Heck Are We Doing in Afghanistan show. I can promise a generous helping of doom, gloom, outrage, and some fun, with insights from Robert Fisk, Tom Hayden, Steve Fournier, and yours truly. Plus, as usual, some good music. I hope you'll stay tuned. If you're listening in Hartford, and this isn't your cup of tea, you're in luck. Just slither down to 1040 on the AM dial, where you're just in time for the Rush Limbaugh show. Today, Rush explains why Adela the Hun is a dangerous communist socialist and why she should be replaced as Secretary of State by Donald Rumsfeld. For those who have stayed behind, welcome and let's go. Today, we take on Afghanistan. And why not? Everybody else has. The ancient Greeks, the British, three times now. The Russians, the Americans, even the Canadians. That's why the national languages of Afghanistan today are Greek, Russian, and Canadian, right? Well, actually, no. Except for opium shippers, everyone who has ever marched into Afghanistan has marched home again, with the shape of an Afghan boot imprinted on his right buttock, and as often as not, with his throat slit. Now comes Mr. Barack Obama, doing the world's best impersonation of John Cleese of Monty Python's Flying Circus. He glances up from his desk, looks us straight in the eye, and says, without a hint of irony,
"And now for something completely different."
But, as even the Russians discovered, Afghanistan is too big to take on alone. So I've assembled my own coalition of the willing. We'll read a great column by activist Tom Hayden, showing that there's no way we can kick the Taliban out of Afghanistan with 50,000 troops, or 100,000 troops, or 5 million troops, for that matter. We'll hear the voice of Robert Fisk and someone new to our show, Steve Fournier. And to liven up what would otherwise be a depressing mess of a show, which accurately reflects a depressing mess of a U.S. foreign policy, we'll hear a couple of songs. In fact, let's hear one now. But first, a brief pop quiz. You recall Dr. Watson, Sherlock Holmes' faithful, if slightly obtuse, sidekick and biographer. Years earlier, Dr. Watson's military career was ended by a wound from an archaic Jizai bullet suffered while fighting a foreign war. Here's the question. In what country did Watson receive the wound that ended his first career? India? No, it wasn't India. South Africa? No, not even close. One more guess. What? No hands? Come on, think. Who was kicking the limey's pale white butts in the 1880s? No, not France. Oh, never mind. Let's hear first from Willie Nelson, and then from Robert Fisk.
There's so many things going on in the world. Babies dying, mothers crying. How much oil is one human life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? We believe everything that they tell us. They're gonna kill us, so we gotta kill them first. But I remember a commandment, thou shalt not kill. And how much is a soldier's life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And whatever happened to peace on earth? So I guess it's just do unto others before they can do it to you. Let's just kill them all and let God sort them out. Is this what God wants us to do? And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And whatever happened to peace on earth? Now you probably won't hear this on your radio, probably not on your local TV. But if there's time and you're ever inclined, you can always hear it from me. But how much is a picker's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth? But don't confuse caring for weakness. You can't put that label on me. The truth is my weapon of mass protection, and I believe that truth sets you free. And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth?
By the way, I do not believe in the clash of civilizations. I do not believe in it. I live in the Muslim world. My landlord is a Druze. My driver is a Sunni Muslim. My classical Arabic translator is a Shiite. And my optician is a Christian. But I don't even think about it. And I don't say happy holiday to people. On December the 25th, my driver wishes me happy Christmas. And at the end of the Eid, I say Eid Mubarak to my landlord. You know, I guess really in a way that we regard each other in the same way, and it's a great quotation from the Imam Ali, who of course is a Shiite divine, who said, if you see another man, and now we'd say a man and a woman, but these were patriarchal times, he said, if you see another man, he is either your brother in religion or your brother in humanity. And that is the only ethical idea with which I think we can look at the Middle East. And they will look at us in the same way. I do believe strongly that we must withdraw our military forces from the Middle East because it is not our land. We must have relations. We must have relations with Muslims. Social relations, political, religious, swamp the whole Middle East with our tourists. The people of the Middle East are very generous. In Iran, they love to see people. They welcome people. Even in Iraq, when I go there still, people still say, welcome, welcome. How? I can't imagine, but they do. But militarily, we must get out. Now, I was giving a talk in the north part of Dublin, Ireland, a few weeks ago, 3 months ago now. And I was sitting with Vincent Brown, a former colleague of mine when I was a reporter in Belfast. He's actually a Southern Catholic. And he said, but surely, Robert, surely, he said, just a minute, surely Islam is a threat to us. And I said, you mean the Egyptian army is in Dublin? You mean the Jordanian army is in Washington? Or is the Lebanese army in London, perhaps? You know? But we don't see it like that. It's the threat, the threat, the threat. And you know, even when we offer Arabs democracy and they take us seriously, we forget to tell them who to vote for. And we gave the Palestinians democracy and those pesky Palestinians voted for the wrong people. The Ottawa citizens said that they should be threatened with another election. So democracy is now a threat if you don't vote for the right people. I mean, I don't think the Palestinians voted for Hamas because they wanted an Islamic Republic. They voted for Hamas because they were sick of the corruption of the Palestinian Authority. I have to say that I find the situation in the Middle East and Southwest Asia utterly hopeless. Television reporters sometimes ring me up and say, can you see any light in the horizon, Bob, at the end of the tunnel? And I say, none. And until you realize there is none, you cannot do anything that will create hope. Stop saying that it's the surge has worked. There's victory in Iraq. There's going to be victory in Afghanistan. Victory in Afghanistan? The Afghans defeated the Greeks, the Persians. They defeated the British in 1842 and wiped out an English army. They defeated us again at the end of the 19th century, in the Victorian age, at the Battle of Maywand. I've actually got, a very dear friend gave me, the official British report on the disasters of the British army fighting the Afghans in 1882. And at the Battle of Mewand, our grenadiers firing in lines, those of you who have seen the film Zulu, have seen how we shoot down our enemies, were attacked by massive Afghan forces. And in the annex to this document, there is a Captain Mannering who reports that during the battle, groups of Afghans wearing black turbans would choose a particular British soldier to seize. And even though many of them were shot down as they did so, they would grab one particular soldier, pull him out of the ranks and cut his throat in front of his comrades. And Captain Mannering says they were called Taliban. This is 19th century Afghanistan. And the Russians went there. I was there, 1980, 1979 they invaded. I saw them coming in, the great armies of Stalingrad arriving. And they were beaten after 10 years. What are we doing? We go to Afghanistan, we say mission accomplished, we set up Hamid Karzai, there's a democracy. Then we run off and invade Iraq and we say mission accomplished, and that goes up in flames. And now we're going back to Afghanistan again, because we're going to win all over again because the Taliban now have half the country. I call it in my paper, Iraqistan, that is our, it takes in Pakistan now. This is the war that we are now fighting. We are told Iran is the great threat. Is it so? I said in California 2 years ago, it is another country we should be worried about, a Muslim country which is packed with Taliban supporters and Al-Qaeda supporters and is totally corrupted, and it has a bomb, and it's called Pakistan. What is the real story of Iran? According to our newspapers, the mad mullahs want a bomb, and then the crackpot Ahmadinejad, he is a crackpot, by the way, is going to use it to destroy Israel. Well, I don't think Ahmadinejad knows one end of a nuclear missile from the other, and anyway, he doesn't control them, and if they were ever fired at Israel, they would destroy all the Palestinians, and then Iran would be destroyed. But the real story of Iranian nuclear power is a little bit more interesting. It was the Shah, our friend, our ally, the Shah of Iran, King of Kings, our policeman in the Gulf, who wanted nuclear facilities. And we Europeans, we lined up, stood on each other's shoulders to sell those facilities to the Iranians. The nuclear facility at Bushehr, supposedly such a great danger to us now, was built by the German company Siemens. And the Shah went to New York on his way to see President Carter at the White House and said in a television interview he'd rather like to have a nuclear bomb. And when asked, politely of course, why, he said, well, the Russians have one, the Americans have one, why shouldn't Iran? Nobody started shouting abuse or saying this is a threat. But when Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, returned to Iran after the Islamic Revolution, he said in a room about this size, and I was present, listening to him and seeing him with my own eyes, he said, nuclear facilities are the work of the devil and we shall close them down. And he did. But that part of the story I've just told you, which many of you will not be familiar with, has been snapped off from the narrative. We have to begin with mad mullahs who want a bomb. And that is what you've been told. And thus, of course, we ignore Pakistan. And this is how it happens. And we journalists let this happen. We thread this narrative for you too. And we're all guilty of doing it. We're all responding to what the White House says, or Downing Street says, or the Quai d'Orsay in Paris. And we don't listen to the people who live in these countries, who would like to like us, but whom we do not intend to give freedom to. And that is the tragedy which we live today. Thank you for your patience, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Here's a nice piece by longtime activist Tom Hayden. It was published January 29th of this year in the Huffington Post. Its title is The Audacity of War by Maps and Population. My friend Bob Mulholland, a disabled Vietnam veteran, has rolled out the relevant maps which reveal the staggering scope of the emerging Afghanistan-Pakistan war. South Vietnam, where Bob fought alongside 500,000 Americans, was 67,000 square miles in 1973. Vietnam as a whole was 129,000 square miles. Iraq today, where there are 150,000 American troops, is 169,000 square miles, somewhat larger than Vietnam. Afghanistan, where Obama proposes deploying some 60,000 American troops, is 252,000 square miles. That's 50% larger than Iraq. If we include Pakistan, where our predators and special units are attacking, we add 340,000 square miles. That makes, in what the Pentagon calls AFPAC, almost 600,000 square miles total. That makes AFPAC 3.5 times the size of Iraq. And you can see how well we brought peace and democracy to Iraq. That's a sidebar comment. Back to the text. Population figures are revealing as well. South Vietnam, where the U.S. forces fought, had 19 million people in 1973. Iraq had 29 million people. Afghanistan, 33 million people. Pakistan, 173 million people. That gives AFPAC 206 million people, more than 7 times the population of Iraq. Bob comments, the troop surge for South Vietnam went to 540,000 U.S. troops in 1968 and still meant nothing in the big picture. Of course, South Vietnam was a lot of mountains, jungles, and rice paddies, unlike Iraq, but it was only 67,000 square miles, or about a quarter the size of Afghanistan, which is a lot of mountainous terrain, also difficult territory. 1 million troops would not stop the jihadist cause in Afghanistan as long as they continue to get money and support, which was the key to the North Vietnamese effort. Ken speaking here, the Taliban are now making a big comeback throughout Afghanistan. Why? Not because the people want an Islamic fundamentalist government, they don't. But because the Taliban bring law, order, and a measure of peace, which the corrupt American puppet government of Hamid Karzai is completely unable to. And the Afghanis certainly prefer the Taliban to the American war criminals who are killing innocent people by the truckload. Literally. Killing them with remote-controlled unmanned bomber planes dropping high explosives and illegal white phosphorus bombs on every wedding party they spy, while the brave American pilots are sitting in air-conditioned comfort just outside Las Vegas, staring at their video monitors and playing with their joysticks. The ultimate in masturbation. Where our brave fly boys, and maybe fly girls, face grave dangers such as losing their paychecks at the craps table, or, at worst, hemorrhoids. I should mention that Tom Hayden's article was not read verbatim, but was edited for radio by yours truly. Here verbatim is Hartford lawyer, activist, and recent Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate, Steve Fournier. Steve runs a blog called Current Invective. That's www.currentinvective.com, where a recent entry pertains to Afghanistan. Steve kindly recorded it for New World Notes.
There's something Americans should know about bombing civilians. If you can't count them, they don't count. That's the rule applied these days by the U.S. media, working in tandem with the Marine Corps. And it's the reason you may not have heard that Marine pilots have been bombing houses in Afghanistan. International Red Cross observers said U.S. aircraft operating in the western province of Farah killed dozens of civilians, including many women and children. Eyewitness accounts tell of truckloads of bodies carted away for burial. Nobody counted them, and they were all in the ground by the time news reporters got around to reporting the bombings. The U.S. media, suppressing most of the story, seemed to be reluctant to report on the massacre because they weren't sure there were enough dead babies to make it worthwhile. The last we heard, they were spewing the Pentagon line, on no evidence whatsoever, that the hapless Afghan women and children were killed by something other than the bombs that fell on them, or that they were herded into harm's way by America's enemies. The truth that the media couldn't report is that America is the enemy. You and I are the enemy. Rich and poor, black, white, and brown, mother and brother, we are aggressive enemies of peace, unattainable in the presence of an occupying army of tens of thousands of heavily armed American soldiers. We are enthusiastic enemies of self-determination, impossible in a country under foreign occupation. We are unabashed enemies of the rule of law, which forbids armed incursions of all kinds except in self-defense. We are unrepentant enemies of life itself, so little concern do we show for the children of farmers and herdsmen, blown to bits by our soldiers. Up till a few months ago, we could chalk it all up to rogue government in Washington. That rationalization evaporated in November, when we had a chance to oust the crooks in charge. We didn't do it. In fact, our esteemed current president promised explicitly to keep the mayhem going, and we seem to have voted for that. He's delivering. It's dead babies by the truckload, and he claims to be proud of the boys and girls we send over there to keep the blood flowing. The soldiers know that they are not heroic, not brave, but cowardly, with their body armor, their pilotless bombers, and their shoot-first rules of engagement. They know that they are not so much soldiers as terrorists, roaring through town and village with guns at the ready. They know that they are dishonored by what the rest of us so foolishly refer to as service. And they know that the civilians at home neither understand nor care about their shame and sadness. Military commanders feign surprise at the number of soldiers killing themselves. They should acknowledge that this is the price of cowardice, of brutality, of lawlessness, of dishonor. These are the hallmarks of 21st century warfare, American style. And there's no cure for dishonor except self-destruction. Some come back and drink themselves to death. Some end up on the street. And some buy a dozen roses for Mom and then put a gun to their heads.
I think we could all use a cheerful song about now. Here's an up-tempo number. I'd like you to think of it as a song of praise for our current Secretary of State, a woman who threatened to obliterate every man, woman, and child in Iran, to wipe Iran off the map should it decide to invade Israel. What makes her think that Iran is contemplating invading Israel is beyond me. Sure, Americans like to dress Ahmadinejad as the devil incarnate, but as Robert Fisk noted not 10 minutes ago, Ahmadinejad has no say, and I suspect little influence, over his country's foreign policy. Another fun fact that Americans are never told is that, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the president has relatively little power, and his responsibilities are almost entirely domestic. Anyway, consider this a song of praise about Hillary Clinton, the woman who is making Americans think of a question they dare not speak aloud. To wit, is this country really ready for a white Secretary of State? Hillary Clinton, the woman who never saw an American military atrocity she couldn't defend, and who never saw an Israeli military atrocity, ever. Anyway, the singer makes a pronoun error or two, but even grammarians will be tapping their feet when they hear this song of praise for Hillary.
Well, come on everybody, get into the spin. Now that he's been in for however long it's been, grin a good old grin, tuck in your second chin, and everybody do the Clinton. Come on and slide over to the middle.
Over to the middle.
Straighten up and step line.
Up and step line.
Lean it to the left a little.
To the left a little.
Now lean a lot to the right.
Lot to the
come
right.
Come on and take a definite position.
Definite position.
Now do a total turnabout.
Total turnabout.
Shake your finger at the media. See how good they'll be to you.
Everybody do the Clinton.
Well, come on everybody, learn another new step. Walk the party line, but be sure to watch where you step. Keep up with a two-step, while Gingrich does the goose step.
Everybody do the Clinton.
Come on and slide over to the middle.
Over to the middle.
Straighten up and step line.
Up and step line.
Lean it to the left a little.
To
now lean a lot to the right.
Lot to the
bend
right.
Over, making everybody happy.
Everybody happy.
Now let the other guy lead.
Other guy lead.
Try appearing Jeffersonian. Bring another crony in.
Everybody do the Clinton.
it's right then. Shuck and jive. Now jam with the band. Come on and slide over to the middle.
Over to the middle.
Straighten up and step line.
Up and step line.
Lean it to the left a little.
To the left a little.
Now lean a lot to the right. Diplomatic sidestep.
Diplomatic sidestep.
Stomp on the nominee.
On the refugee.
Start to feel a little ill at ease with your own abilities.
Everybody do the Clinton.
Now do the old administrative shuffle.
Administrative shuffle.
And the continental hop.
Continental hop.
Have another waffle.
Have another waffle.
And try to flip your latest flop. There and try to keep on trucking.
Try to keep on trucking.
Take it one step at a time.
One step at a time.
Do just like your mama says. Make good on your promises.
Everybody do the Clinton.
Do just like your mama says. Make good on your promises.
Everybody do the Clinton.
Well, he either will or he won't. It's up to Hillary.
Everybody do the Clinton.
Do the Clinton.
That was The Foreman and Everybody Do the Clinton from their 1995 album. Amazingly, 14 years ago, they predicted the rise to power of now Secretary of State Clinton. Thanks for listening. For the Robert Fisk passage, our thanks to Mariah Gillardin and TUC Radio. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of anyone even remotely connected with the station, though Leo the janitor says he liked that last song, especially the a cappella ending. Your comments and suggestions are most welcome. Write to Kenneth Doust, New World Notes, WWUH-FM, University of Hartford, West Hartford, Connecticut, 06117, or send me an email. To do that, or to get a podcast, a free download, pretty pictures, more information, go to the blog. That's at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Until next time, from darkest New England, here's wishing you a good week. Illegitimi non carborundum. Try to speak the truth and keep the faith.
And now for something completely different.